money. So, according to Marx, money was a big lie, in the sense in which you have a piece of paper, but the piece of paper means nothing. It's the value that you attribute to the paper who is. I'll give you an example. You go to the bus, you need to pay to the guy, and you have two banknotes of £5. One is very dirty and is not very well, I mean it's almost broken, but it's all dirty with different things, and the other is brand new. Which one you the bus driver picking up first?
The new one.
Why?
More valuable.
Yeah, you see, it's the same, it's £5, but people believe, and this is to prove to you that the paper, the banknote, is irrelevant. It's what you believe that represent. And you can see that an example in countries who have a huge inflation, like Russia, or in countries in South America, in which people do not believe in money anymore. So they use that as a symbolic exchange, but they don't believe in the money. And there is an example which is perfect. In South America, in the 70s, was a huge inflation, and all the coins were circulating. But at some point, the value, the metallic value of the coin, was more important than what the money, the coin, supposed to represent. You know what the people do? They sell it as a metal and not as a money. You see, so in 1 week, all the coins disappear from the market because the people were selling that as a metal. You see why? Because people don't trust money anymore. Why? Because money is be trust. You believe that the pound is a strong symbol, and then it's going to be present now and forever. I mean, it's funny because if you look at stations, different stations, I think in Paddington there is something still. In the past, people were so confident about the stability of the money that they used to put in bronze, they used to put in metal, writing the penalty for different things. Do you imagine? I mean, now that is unthinkable because we know there is inflation, and I don't know, if they find you with £5 this week, they will find you 15 next week. But at the beginning of the century, for example, especially here in England, this idea of confidence in the money was so strong that the people were putting on the wall, fixed, forever, like I said, £5 is going to be £5 forever. This idea that, and this is what Marx says, that the capitalism created this imagine idea of stability, because we believe that if we possess the money, we possess the value, and that is not true. And it's true that a lot of people believe that. Well, an example, I'll give you an example. My grandfather, my grandfather used to be, well, was Jewish, and he said, Claudio, what I got here is what counts, and the rest do not exist. He was thinking that the possess in the task, the money, was really the thing, and that is irrelevant, because an example, if you were in Germany in the 30s, 200% of inflation per day, so what we have here became paper just in half hour. When I was a student in South America, I was a researcher in an institute, so I get my salary, and inflation was so big that there were two queues. One, you cash the money in the value of the national currency, and the other was to picking up dollars. So all the pension people and my colleagues were doing one queue and immediately going the other. Well, took me 10 minutes to go one window to the other. Well, I lost 25-30% of the value of the money in 15 minutes. You see, so that's to give you an idea, this sense of sort of, like Abelio says, is this evaporation, is this idea that vanishing, everything is vanishing. The values one day are fixing a particular thing and then disappear. And that's being me again. Remember the idea of sign, you see? What happened is that if you have the three reference points, you have a sign, you can make your mind about a particular meaning, let's say a table, because you have the interpretation, you have the concept, and you have the physical element. But what happens sometimes is that in some cultures, an example, the connection between the concepts and the physical system disappear. So things don't make any sense no more. In a sense, an example, take an instant here in England, the hospitals. During the 19th century, they construct this huge hospital, big ones, in this brick, nice style. Well, after the Second World War, this hospital became completely obsolete. So, for what they use it? They use it for, I don't know, for pediatric purpose first, then they close it down, they divide it in flats, and you see, something was designed to be something, and then with the past running of the time, you start to use it for another purpose. So there is no connection. You have a hospital who says hospital, but there are flats. You see, it's this change of meaning of things who is going so quickly that we cannot afford anymore to construct a building and put on the building hospital, because who knows what is in 2 years going to be. And that is again something connected with this idea that we move constantly. I mean, the idea that we are not fixed in a particular place, and this is our culture as well, in one way or the other, a culture of everything is transition. We move constantly. We live in a way, as one of my friends in London says, Claudio, I have in my home whatever fit in my car. If it don't fit, I trash it. You see, if it's a good or bad, I don't know, but this is a person who is 40 something, which is not a student anymore, but it's a person who is living our time. It's a person who says, I don't want to have things where I cannot move quickly. Why? Because I need, we are forced to move quickly. You see? Culture is exactly the same, especially when we don't have matter to anchor, because this is the problem. Where we anchor the culture. If I ask you, what is the meaning of British culture? What you say to me? I remember when I was a student in King College, we spent a whole seminar. A professor who was a very nice man, he was doing cultural studies, he said, one day he raised the question, I think I was the only foreigner, and I said, what is the meaning of British culture? I said, we don't have a clue. So he said, well, we are going to a seminar. So we spent 3 months trying to explore what was this idea. At the end of these 3 months, we came across to fish and chips, Manchester United, and so on. But nothing really, really. And this was not a moral judgment in the sense in which you say, this is good, this is bad. No, it was the fact that the people cannot anchor what they do ordinary to things in the past, an example. And an example of here, if you ask around here in Devon, how the people used to eat here. I mean, let's say 50, 60 years ago, 70 years ago, well, young people don't have a clue about that. And there are a lot of elements in which they used to cook who disappear already. So even if you have all the goodwill of this planet to, let's say, eat according to the place in which you are, the elements already disappear. So you never are going to recover this roots from the past in that way, you see. And this is one of the problems that Virgilio discussed very nicely. We have a sort of gap with the past. So it's not the fact that we say we are not looking back to the past to construct bridges and figure out an identity. No, it's that we cannot make it. Why? Because we don't have concepts. So if we have plans and we have concepts, yes, maybe we can make a reconstruction of the past, and more important, we can construct concept facing the future, the expectation. You see, because this is the other problem that this culture of invisibility posed to us. We expect things constantly. We are living in the future in one way or the other. I mean, I give you my example if you want, but in university I'm planning with 3 years ahead constantly. So I'm living in 2008 or 2009. The present is irrelevant. You are expecting that you are going to university. When you are in university, you are expecting to get a job. When you get a job, you are expecting to make a trip. And when you get a trip, then you are expecting to get a pension. You see, you always are chasing like the future. And this is called expectation. And this is very, very, very important, because what you expect from the future is what you are going to do in the present. You see? So that is, if you want, the cultural picture in which theory, in my view, is relevant. Question? Yeah? So how you fit this? I don't know. Give me an example. What book, literary book, you have been reading lately? No? A book?
For pleasure.
Yeah, whatever. Doesn't matter. Well, whatever. I know. I don't know.
I'm studying cutting the one.
Okay. Do you know that?
Cutting the cloth.
No. Oh, let's pick up someone. I thought, just to give an example, a classic. Well, Dickens. All of you know Dickens. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, if you are aware of this situation, of this cultural evolution, and you came across to Hard Times, an example. So, what you can do? Well, number one, an example. You can reconstruct what is the idea of war in Dickens' book. An example of what are the reference to reality. How many ideas of reality you can check in the book. That's one possibility. If there is any sense of money within the book, how that has been defined. It is used, or for what purpose it is used. If there is an idea of work, and which is quite a lot of the idea of work, what is the meaning of that work? Means something which is ethical, it is good, it is bad, what kind of work came up in the novel? So, that's if you want at the level of the plot. If you want at the level of the language, well, you can go deeply and see, well, probably with Dickens normally use quite a lot of the third person and some dialogue. So you can see the novel how this narration, the first person, which is normally is the narrator, the capital, connect with the dialogues and how they manage. And this brings me to something else. You see what I meant? You all have two possibilities. You go to the plot and you explore concepts, or you go to the level of the language and you explore, if you want, the plan. And the plan is this. Okay, we normally call this man the author. So the author talk. And create a narrator. The narrator as well talk and create the character or personage, if you want. And he made statements. Doesn't matter what text you are reading, doesn't matter if it's physics, mathematics, literature, whatever. This scheme always, remember this, always is going to be there. So you have the first level, the level of the author, the second level, the level of the narrator, and the third level, the level of the character. So, if you are going to do an analysis in the second sense we were discussing of Dickens, what you do is this. You explain to me what is the relation between the author, the narrator, and the narrator of the character. Or, more easily, you do it the other way around, which is normally. My advice and example to undergraduate students is, as an undergraduate student, you deal with this level in first year, probably as well in the second year. You will deal with the second level of the narrator in the final year. And only in a postgraduate level, you deal with the author. The three are connected, true. But they are not the same. I have students, an example, who in Latin American courses came to see, they start to discuss a book and say, Garcia Marquez says, and I kill them. Why? Because Garcia Marquez does not speak in the book. It's the narrator who speaks, you see? These are simple things, but they are crucial. One thing is the author, because the author as well maybe make another books, you see? Or maybe someone wrote a biography about the book, and we need about the author, and we need to consider all this. So it's a very complex. As soon as we consider all this relevant, then yes, we can jump to the next level, and we analyze the narrator. What is? It's a third-person style? Is it a first-person omniscient? What kind of a style? You can figure out that easily. And then we go to the character. And when you have the three, then you can characterize a particular novel. Okay? So, these have no name, but this is a theoretical principle. You cannot mess up this level. They are separated. They are entangled, but they are separated. And always are present. Doesn't matter, in some cases, maybe you think the narrator is not there, but always is there, even in a small part. So, basically what you have is, or you analyze the plot looking for some particular concept, let's say money, or you analyze the space of a novel, and you see how these people connect. What I'm trying to say to you is, this idea of culture that I explained to you can be deployed, can be analyzed in a book, and the way to do it is this one. It's very simple. The idea of culture or revolution of culture seemed very complicated, but when things became in a practical way, are very, very, very simple. So then you have several authors, the ones who discuss, or critics, the ones who put the emphasis on the author, the ones who maybe says the narrator is more important, and the one who says, probably the most simple one, who says the character is what counts, means the plot. If the plot is entertaining, it's good literature. If not, it's crap literature. You see? So that's the thing. And also, if you want to be more sophisticated, you mix number one, means the analysis of the plot, if you want, with this. And that would be the top, if you want one with the other. In which, an example, you explain to me the concept of money in hard times, but at the same time, you explain to me how, within that scheme, money works for the author, for the narrator, and for the character, or for one of them. Okay? Is that clear? Yeah? Talk to me, eh? Tell me, because if you don't say nothing, I keep going and going and going, and things are going and growing and growing. You see? So I don't know, you stop me.
For me, it's not very clear how to analyze things, when the difference between concept and plan.
When you think in plan, think in space. Think in this. Think in the book. So you have a book, and inside the book you have spaces. Of course, these spaces are imaginary, but who are these spaces? Are people? Are spaces, linguistically speaking, I meant. Okay? I mean, when you use the language, not a space, you say the city. Of course, the city is there in a hard time. No. What I refer is the use of the language. How many forms of the space the language represents to you? And in that sense, how you can identify that? Well, you follow the person. You have one absent person, which is the author. You have one third person, or one third person, which normally is the narrator. And we have someone who has been defined by somebody else, which is the character. These are the linguistic spaces within the novel, and you can follow that, because normally when the narrator talks, he uses the I expression, or he uses the other, he's talking like a first person, but he's not saying I, which is a sort of implicit narrator. Okay? So when the character is talking, he's talking straight away. He's not saying I am talking. No, he's talking straight away. Okay, so there are ways in which language is used to define these spaces. There are particular ways in which each one of these elements, spaces, are expressive. You can identify that easily. Each author is different, of course, because they have different styles. There isn't a sort of a standard. That's the reason why I'm picking up Dickens, because this these novels, these big novels from the 19th century, more or less they were always the same. There wasn't a narrator who was controlling like a puppet all the characters, you see, so it's so easy to understand that. It's getting more complicated in the 20th century when this level start to switch. Calvino, Borges, what they do, they put the author as a character, and that's why you have Borges and I, an example, this beautiful short story in which Borges play with the idea that he is an author, but the author is as well a character. Or you have Calvino, Se una notte d'inverno un viaggiatore, this idea is one night of winter, a traveler, in which the narrator starts to talk to the reader, which is unthinkable, and says, as I say in the page 39, you see, he starts to play with all these levels, mixing up them in one way or the other. This is typical from the 20th century, because the scheme I made for you, 1, 2, 3, is 19th century, in which everything was clear. The author was there, far away, only in the cover of the book. Because you, an example, let's begin up Zola, Nana. Okay? So, imagine for a moment, Nana. So you have Nana, Zola. It's the only moment in which the author came up. You open, and that's it. You have a narrator. Zola is gone. Okay? And then you have character. You see? That's 19th century. Very simple, very straightforward. The problem is, when you have Borges here, but there is a character called as well, hopefully it's Borges. So you say, fuck, what we do? That is when things are getting complicated. But don't worry, one step at a time. The important thing now is the diagnosis. I will be more than happy if you today walk away from here, and of course, maybe some things are dark, but the basic thing, you understood that there is a cultural evolution, you understood that there is a switch from one type of culture into the other, you understood that the classic scheme to understand, let's say, the literature has moved from the 19th century to something more complicated in the 20th century, and it's going to be twisted more. So this is important for you to have a general picture. Then we are going to go grounded one step at a time. Okay? So that's all right. Then let's say, for instance, that our interest is a book. Okay? So, one author, well, several authors, but the one in particular in the 1920s says that when we lost the war in the sense of nature, because nature with capitals, we cannot justify the existence of that anymore, we, in one way or another, we profit with the book, and the book replaced this idea of nature, if you want to know what it is. What he was trying to say was that some artistic objects, like a book, can in one way or the other operate as in the past the idea of war was operating. Why? Because we construct aesthetical objects to understand what happened to us. So, because nature cannot make the explanation of what is unknown, because remember, in the 16th century, people who was having this confidence that doesn't matter what can happen, always nature is going to be there, that was very comfortable, because doesn't matter what you think, doesn't matter what you do, you know always that the net is going to be there, and the net was nature. You can make a mistake, but always nature is going to be there. So this idea that you rely in something that is called God or nature is very comfortable from the knowledge point of view. But the problem is, if we lost that network, we are like a funambulist without the net. So So that's very risky. And that is what this author says happened with the avant-garde movement at the beginning of the 20th century. We lost nature. So basically we are fucked. In the sense in which we cannot be sure anymore that what we are doing is going to be right, is going to be understood, is going to be useful for us. We have this uncertainty. And that creates unpleasant things. And that creates sadness. And that is that this is all about in the 20th century. To in one way or the other consolate us from that sadness, from that lost, if you want. So he proposed that the book in one way or the other can be understood as a space as well. So you have the text, and then in one way or the other you have footnotes, then if you want you have the color, then if you want you have the back cover, and then as well there is a reference here who brings you to another book who is comment, and there is someone who mentioned an author here, you see, and on and on and on. These are the notes that you were taking when you were reading a book. Well, this is called text, and all this surrounding here is called paratext. This is a theory coming from a guy called Gerard Genette, and it's another way to understand space within an object. I make with literature because it's a simple one, but we can do that as well. An example with paintings. So let's imagine for a moment we were having a classic representation here coming from 17th century, let's say, in which we represent what we see, because as better representation we have, more true, more better is going to be the painting. Okay? So the idea is that this is a copy of something coming from the world. So the artistic, the painting is here, is watching the world, he gets feedback from the world, and he produces the painting, and the painting connects to the world. Okay? That was his key. What happened is that this connection disappeared. So what we have? Picasso, if you want one or the other. Dada. We have the avant-garde movement at the beginning of the 20th century. People who are not doing anthropomorphic form anymore. People who do not believe in representation, because they say there is nothing to represent. Nature with capitals do not exist anymore. So what we are going to represent? Art is not about representation, says these people, is about creation. We create the reality. The reality is not in nature. And this has to do with the movement, it's called surrealism. As you know, that's coming from surrealité, which is the reality which is up. If you remember, we're discussing that we have the man in the world. So the question is, this man who is completely lost in the middle of this chaotic world, what he do? How he can survive? How he can understand something? The people who produce the surrealist movement propose that this man create an object, who normally is an artistic object. Something who could be outside the world. Not outside because it's outside the borderline, but outside because it's new. Outside because it's something who did not exist before, and because the meaning is unknown yet. So that object is going to be your instrument to negotiate your position within the world. So you create objects not only to understand who you are, but to understand where you are. That's the idea of surrealism. Of course, they associate paintings and poetry under the same scheme. You see, I try to show you different manifestations of the same problem. We started talking about a change, a switch in the way in which culture is perceived. We have been seeing that in literature. in the 19th century, and how that switched off. We see that as well if you want in painting. Now, an example. You don't have any more painting here and the world here. Basically, what you have is that the painting is trying to become a world in its own, because it's the only thing the artists have. The artists do not have any more nature. The only thing he has is a painting. There is this film from Peter Greenaway, The Drawman, I think it is. The Drawman. The Men Who Made Design, or something like that. There's a copy in the library. I advise you to have a look at that. It's very interesting, because he discusses the man is someone who has been hired from a family to produce different draw from a particular villa. But it's interesting because all this idea of perspective, and this is this sort of dialogue between cinema and how the camera is placed, and how the artist is placing the vision. So there is all this encounter between cinema made in the 20th century and a character who tried to see the world with a 17th century perspective. Okay, so you see the clash there. It's very, very interesting, and that can give you a picture of what we're talking about. So, questions? No?
Yeah.
Jeanette. And the book is called Sail in French. In English has been translated, I think it's called Borderline, no. I don't remember. But you found it easily, because he had two books, important ones. One is this one that I don't remember the name of translation in English, and the other is the literature second degree. So these are the two. I'm sure they are there. So we have another problem with connection with literature. Let's say that is a problem who exists right from the 19th century, but who has been in one way or the other raised more in the 20th century. And it is the accumulation of works. I mean, for someone who was writing in the 17th century, there are not that many authors, and there are not that many books. But what happened is that we were piling up during centuries more authors, more books, more authors, more books. So we have a problem now, which is something that Borges has nicely addressed in different ways, which is the problem that seems that everything has been written already, and seems that everyone in this planet is an author, or because he's a journalist, or because he's a traveler, or I don't know what, but seems that everyone is writing a book about something. So if that is the situation, what the hell is the meaning of literature? That's a big problem, and that is when some people bring theory as well, because they say the only way to make distinction between what in some ways isn't a sort of acceptable literature, because we use the language, because there are important elements there, and what is trash, the only way to do it is with theory, because we can assess books using theory. It's the only way. Of course, I mean, you can discuss, you can argue that sometimes theory, or some people who, or critics, they try to show themselves more than really honestly make an assessment of a book. Yes, and that brings as well the problem that we discussed already, the problem of the value. Everything has value. So if you write a book about, let's say, John Smith wrote a book about Salman Rushdie, so who is more important, Salman Rushdie or John Smith? It's a matter of value. So So John Smith will not accept ever saying that he is a sort of complement of Salman Rushdie, because he will say that Salman Rushdie is who it is because John Smith, another John Smith, another John Smith write about him. And Salman Rushdie will say, no, I'm who I am because I have talent and you don't. You see? So this is the legal discussion. Who are the true? I don't know. And I think both cases are true, but I think it depends specifically what you analyze. The conclusion could be completely different. You can give a reason to John Smith, or sometimes you can give a reason to Salman Rushdie. You see? So what I'm saying to you is that all these things that we have been seeing very, very, very quickly are present in our condition. So what I'm trying to do every time I'm showing you something or discussing this book, more than refer to literature, I try to refer to culture. Because what happened is, for reasons that we are going to see later, in Europe, all the more important theory, at least up to the 19th century, who has been applied to different domains originally, were defined in literature. And that has to do with the specific place that the language have within European culture. And this has to do as well with this, I don't know if you heard something about Shapir and Wolf, who were two linguistics, and they have an hypothesis which is called the hypothesis of Shapir and Wolf, and they say that the structure of particular society is defined by the structure of the language that the society uses. Alright? So a lot of people say that that is very true for Europe, in the sense in which language has been a privileged tool for centuries in Europe. So no one should be surprised if someone doing philosophy of science or history of science can see a model of literature there, or a model who has been used in literature first. Why? Because all the culture in Europe has been literary orientated, at least up to the 20th century. And that's exactly what has been changed. And that's what Virilio discussed nicely in War and Cinema. And Virilio's proposal is that the place that we used to attribute in Europe to literature now is in the hands of images, or if you want, cinema. And more than cinema, cinematography, which is slightly different. So that's as well Baudrillard and other people as well discuss this situation. So any question? You are seems shook.
Sorry, yeah. All these theories, actually, what I understand is that there is hypothesis that there is no real world anymore, and because of capitalism, all these theories agree with this.
Well, there are different theories. There are people who says, because the capitalism is not working anymore, all the philosophical grounds who have been justifying the capitalism disappear at the same time. An example, if you read all the explanation about the wall, the Berlin Wall, when the Berlin Wall just disappeared, have to do with this. They think in the same way. They say all the elements who were justifying the communism just disappear. So boom, they disappear. And there are people who say the same. The capitalism was working at a particular moment, they disappear in one way or the other, so all the things who were together, philosophically speaking, but the problem is not if you believe or not that the nature do not exist anymore. The problem is that people do not believe in nature, because this is not a matter of true or not true. It's a matter of what the people use. I mean, if you talk with people nowadays, an example, it doesn't matter, your friends, whatever, they don't believe in nature in this way. They don't believe that there is something outside there who justifies the behavior they have. No way. They have an artificial life, completely. They believe that people are mad, with a reason. They believe that some people are very bad because they are very bad. But people don't argue anymore saying it's something who get twisted in nature. Or they don't argue anymore saying, well, God wanted in that way, or things like that. I mean, there is not a big scheme, a big narration like a God of nature that justifies your ordinary life. That just blow up. And this is important. Why? Because if that happened, what is the meaning of culture? Because culture, up to the 17th century, was grounded in the idea of God. We reproduce in earth what God is in the sky in one way or the other. And if we do that, we are in happiness. So if that's low, what we do? Poor miserable men, as Nietzsche says. What we do? What kind of culture we need to have to be happy and not unhappy? So that's the whole discussion. And literature again. So what I'm saying to you is that all this evolution, cultural evolution in Europe, in one way or the other, put people in a difficult situation in which the traditional concepts of literature, of understanding, of knowledge, of philosophy disappear. And we need to start to think from scratch. The question is that possible? Some people say yes, some people say no. So that is the, to make very, very short, abstract. Alright? Well, we stop here. Okay? So, we are going to see, I'm going to send you an email probably tomorrow or during the weekend with all the recommended reading from this book, and I am going to post probably on Monday all the PDF. However, you can go to the library. So I'm going to do phenomenology and hermeneutics. I'm going to explain to you in the first hour of the 15 what is the meaning of phenomenology, how really you can understand phenomenology, and a sort of critical comment, and then hermeneutics in the second hour. So make sure that in chapter 2 you take some notes and you are familiar with that. It's not that long.
Chapter
2 is the one who corresponds to phenomenology and hermeneutics, which is are all together, phenomenology and hermeneutics, but I prefer to separate one to the other, even if they are in parallel one way or the other. Okay? That's the first task. The second task is start to think a title, as object, whatever you want to do, as I say, and bring me something. If you are struggling and your brain is dead, I give you something. Depend on you. But I would prefer to start to discuss, and let's say for the 1st of March, at the latest, you should have already a title and a clear idea what we are going to do with the essay. Why? Because it's much better, even if you read the whole book and you read all the essay I give it to you, it's much better, let's say, if at the middle of the course you already have an idea because of what you are going to do. Why? Because all the things we are discussing here, you focus already in your essay. Because at the end of the day, you need to produce the essay. And that as well is important, not only understanding. And that is when I can help you more, because if we have a concrete thing, you come to see me and you can say to me, a lot of students, MA, PhD, say, Claudio, I'm lost. I don't have a clue how to connect this book with this subject. No problem, piece of cake. We do that together. We can do it all together, we can do it individually, doesn't matter, you let me know. But if we start to have this kind of exchange outside, let's say, the seminar, I mean, I say for middle of March, before the Easter, you already have few substantial notes, and over Easter you write the essay. It should be a piece of cake. Even if we didn't finish the course. But you can add things, complement, change. That should be easy. And then, because I would like to see how you are in action, I would like to see your writing, because I just need from you a half page to see if you are going to be in trouble or not. And I tell you straight away, I don't have a problem. I'm continental man. Italian, to be more exact. Because it's better if you know that and you know where to tackle the problems. Okay?
Should it be drawn from something like the title of the essay or the kind of subject of the essay? Should it be drawn from something from the books that you've given us, like,
taking
one of the themes of...
That could be one possibility. Could be an example that you already have an idea about the dissertation. And maybe this is an opportunity to use all the theoretical tools to help you to write a better dissertation. Therefore, you can pick up what concept that you think you are going to use substantially in the dissertation. An example, I don't know, in your case, for example, could be I don't know, time against space. I mean, because one of the problems that the theory faced in the 20th century is that all the philosophies grounded on time, meaning in which time has been a strong concept, disappeared. Hermeneutic is the last one. And now we are facing theories, like Averillo, which are grounded in space, or if you want, in images. So, question for you. If that is the situation, why some people believe that we have almost a direct connection with the medieval times? I mean, Umberto Eco writes a lot about, I mean, so you have plenty, you see, the connection is how you work it out. And for the rest of you, I mean, you just let me know, because we have been discussing, so that's why I know what he's doing, but you let me know what you're doing and I give you connections. No problem. Alright, well, thank you very much. We keep in touch by email, okay? And I send you an email when everything will be on the web properly, and I as well this one. Thank you.